Welcome to The Graveyard Shift, the podcast where anything goes, as long as there's a good story to tell. Join Todd, Matt, Jimmy, and Gary as they bust myths and share advice that hopefully isn't terrible. Let's dive in.
Well, welcome everyone to The Graveyard Shift. And we're really excited today to be taking a little different approach here with our podcast. And we're going to be sharing the spotlight and sharing the microphone. I'm a little afraid to do that, but, you know, I kind of have no choice, so we'll give it a shot. And we're going to be asking each other some burning questions about the people and the experiences that have shaped our careers and our lives. Maybe. And we'll see how they go. I have no idea what questions have been prepared for the three other amigos on this on the Graveyard Shift today, but I guess we're going to find out. So we'll be playing a little rotating host. And again, that's definitely a first for the program. So we hope you find this podcast informative and entertaining. And if we do that, you know, hey, we've done our jobs. So what we'll do is we're going to start off here. Jimmy, I hate to do this, but, you know, start with you, Jimmy. And, you know, in any order that you want, like, you know, we're going to do a round, get some questions on the table. We'll wax philosophical and then, or not. And then we, or attempt to, and then we will, rotate hosts, and then we'll hopefully maybe get through this one or two or three questions here. We'll see how it goes. So I have to admit this, I feel a little bit like the Wendellas or whatever, the trapeze artists, you know, when they're stepping out over, you know, the Empire State Building on a tightrope and there's no net and it's just a windy day.
It's the Wendellas, yeah.
Flying Wendellas.
That's correct.
Wear a helmet.
There we go. Thank you for clarifying that, Gary. So with that setup, Jimmy, why don't you just kind of give us your best shot?
Okay. Well, welcome, caller. Glad to have you on.
Let's go to Poughkeepsie.
Well, Evan Berger from Law and Order.
I was excited about this because I'm completely gonna take you off guard with what you think I might come at you with. I'm going to start with a serious question that I think is an important question. So this profession can be hard, and this is for all you guys. I didn't just give a one-off on this one. This profession can be hard on spouses and families. What have you done to make it easier on those closest to you?
What's the next question?
Boxers, briefs, commandos, or something we've never seen before.
No, that's an excellent question, and I think it's I don't know if I have a perfect answer for it. I mean, I'm like you, Jimmy. I was raised as an undertaker's kid, and I got to see what that means, you know, growing up, and it was, you know, we were very often at the table eating before my dad got home. We'd hear him coming up the steps, you know, halfway through dinner, and he'd be there for part of it, and then he'd be shooting back out. I think a lot of us joke, you know, is my dad was the best dressed guy on the sidelines or the best dressed guy at the Scout Court of Honor or whatever the thing you might have been involved with. I've tried to be intentional. I think I remember it was my son's, I think it was his second or third birthday party, and I left it for, we got a call and I had to go. I was on call. So it was the nature of life. So I've tried to be very intentional about taking my time and going with them and being with them, especially as the kids have gotten older and I, you know, realize we'll be, you know, empty nesters in 5 years, which seems like just yesterday they were born. So, you know, trying to make the games, trying to take the trips, trying to do the things, and also trying to be fair with them. If because of my life and work and schedule, I can't participate in something, not saying I expect them to just stay home and wait for me to get home is the sad dog waiting for the owner to come home, like letting them live fully and do the stuff.
All right. Well, good stuff, man. Hey, I don't mind, Jimmy. Is that for all of us? Is that a question for all of us? All right. Yeah. I'm going to break mine down into two parts because early in my career, I was a funeral director. And, you know, it's a long time ago now because you can tell by the amount of gray in my beard, in my hair, that was a minute ago. And, you know, I would echo, you know, I didn't grow up in a funeral home family like Matt did. You know, I had my hometown funeral director, his oldest son was a friend of mine and one of my older brother's best friend. And so I got I knew that this profession existed, but I didn't really know what that meant. Decided to become a funeral director, and thanks to some of the influence that Mike had on my life and his dad, Chuck. By the way, still an active funeral director, and he's like 90 and doing great. Wow. Just crazy. And
that's
small
the dream
town
right
life.
There.
Yeah.
Funeral directors never die. They just go on a last call.
So, I was a funeral director in a really small town in southern Minnesota, farming community. But you know, yeah, same thing. The phone rings, you go to work, right? You know, I think my agreement with my employer gave me every other Sunday off if there were no visitations or funerals. And it was a nice lifestyle. I mean, we really enjoyed it. It was one of those things where when you work, when there's not much work, cause it's between a couple locations. When we started, we're doing like 70 funerals a year. It was, you know, there was plenty of downtime to catch up. But that's hard, man. It's like the unexpected changes to schedule. You know, family really does have to adjust to that, and I did too. Now, after that, I got into the prepaid funeral side of the business. You know, in software and Passari and all that. And I'll tell you, that's a different lifestyle. That one, I chose to have more predictability in my schedule, but the travel. My goodness, I was a road warrior, drove 40, 50,000 miles a year for 12, 15 years, a lot of time on the road, a lot of time in hotel rooms. You know, it was that was the hardest part about being away. But normally I could pick when I could be home. But, you know, I got to the point on one of my first pre-need opportunity I was working is I just gave it up because I was starting to miss parent-teacher conferences, and I can't do that. So I had to make a decision on my future, and I made that decision. And after 7 years of a lot of good things happening in my life, but I couldn't do that anymore. So signed up and got a different gig, you know, because my family was suffering too much.
Thanks, Todd. So how is that balance?
Yeah. I'm sorry, you just Todd or me?
That question for yeah.
Yeah, like was that a sigh of relief for your family, or, you know, what was complete support? Like,
yeah, well, it was, we got into, it was weird. We had a rhythm. Life on the road. Yeah. Life on the road is interesting because there's these transitions. Like you have the transition when you're leaving, and then, you know, so my wife's getting ready to handle everything with the kids and do her deal and run the house. And then I come home on Friday, and then she wants to kind of have me be more responsible for things. So it turned out being away was not as difficult. Being home was great, but the transitions were tough.
Yeah.
Because
yeah,
it upsets the flow in the home.
Thank you.
Thank
well,
you.
Well, I have a very similar story to Todd. When I got out of business school, my father and I bought a company, and I spent the first 8 or 9 years working 90, 95 hours a week. There every weekend. I've never been at the mercy of at need. It was all a self-inflicted wound. But it finally basically broke me. I couldn't keep doing it. And I had children. And that was more important to me than anything. So I did two things. I made a commitment that I was going to be as big a part in my kids' lives as I possibly could be until they were out of the house. And the second is I learned how to delegate. When I was running that manufacturing company, I did everything. I ran machine tools. I wrote the mechanics manual. I did product development. And basically, I kept all the decision-making in my office. And I think I've talked about this on the podcast before. When you do that, you make everybody around you weaker because they know that if there's a decision to be made, they're going to walk into your office and ask you to make the decision. So, for me, it was really learning how to delegate, and I actually took the Spring Grove job. I figured I'd be here 3 to 4 years because I was coaching 30 to 40 hours a week. I had 3 AAU basketball teams and 2 youth football teams. To give you an idea, in 2007 was the last year I did it. between March 1 and August 1, I coached 98 basketball games and ran 75 practices. And not all of them were in Cincinnati. So I took Spring Grove, figuring I could do that. I wouldn't have to travel. And it worked out really well. And then after my kids got into the school program, I got much more involved in ICCFA and the business. And that's been my focus now. But I definitely have a balance. I work more than 40 hours a week, but I rarely work more than 8 hours a day. I'll pick up a couple hours in the mornings. Even when I go on vacation, I work a couple hours in the mornings because I'm up before everybody else. So I've found a way to balance it. I try not to bring the stress home. Every once in a while it gets to me. But in general, I've got a team that works for me now that has, between the six of them, probably 100 years of experience. And there's nothing that can happen at Spring Grove that they haven't seen before. And there's only one thing that I would want to personally have to interject myself in, and that would be if 60 Minutes shows up at the front door. Other than that, any kind of bad, worst case scenario, all that stuff, my people can handle that. They may ask me my opinion, but there's nothing that can happen, even if it really hit the fan, that the team that reports to me can't handle. Now, you can't, in a small business, it's a lot harder to do that. I was fond of the quote, in a small business, the best thing is you get to do everything. And the worst part of it is you have to do everything. So, you know, you got to have a scale of business to be able to get to where I am. But if you can work your way there, it'll lower the stress in your life, and it will also make the people around you stronger.
Mm-hmm. Good advice.
So my only concern in all of that is that you wrote an operating manual.
That I wrote an operating manual?
Is that what you said? You wrote an operating manual for machinery?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Lots of them. I actually have two.
So we know where all the defective parts came from.
Yeah. Yeah. We know when 60 Minutes showed up. It was shortly after he implemented it.
You better worry about OSHA. Forget 60 Minutes.
I actually had two patents from my time in the manufacturing world for product development.
That's pretty cool.
I didn't know that about Gary. I've known Gary a long time. I didn't know about the machine shop thing.
I know. Yeah, I can see him back there.
What a successful episode.
To be honest, Todd, there was a guy that running one of the machine tools that thought, since he was the only one that knew how to run it, he could act like a horse's backside. And I said, no, you can't. Have a nice day. Get out of here. And I flew to Buffalo for a week and learned how to operate the equipment. And then I took over and ran it for about a month until we could train somebody else.
Wow. Don't mess with Gary Freitag.
Yes. Oh, I couldn't learn it today. My brain's mush.
Awesome. Well, hey, thanks, Jimmy. That was a good first round right there. Good shot out of the gun. And hey, Matt, you're up next. So give us your best stuff.
Gary, you started to touch on coming into the profession. And then the thing I was wondering for you is what first drew you into the death care space, and what's kept you here longer than any of us ever expected?
Way longer than I expected. I'm surprised I'm not in jail too, but you know, I've got really good attorneys. The answer to that is a recruiter. I had no interest in the profession. My wife and I were both entrepreneurs at that point, and one of us had to go get a quote unquote real job. And so I got a call, and I literally remember when the guy told me what it was. I put the old style receiver against my chest and went, oh, this is going to be great. And he told me, and I said, what made you call me? What on my resume looks anything like I belong in the cemetery world? And what they were looking for is somebody that had a totally different perspective, because we had Tom Smith, who had run the cemetery for 28 years. And our CFO had been there for 25. They wanted somebody literally with marketing, IT, and finance, experience. And that was the three things I worked the most in. What kept me here, and again, I did it because I was coaching all that time. I figured I could do the job in about 30 hours a week, and I was right initially. But once I got here, I think the thing that flipped a switch for me is I started to understand how special Spring Grove was, how unique it is. And the other thing I tell, I'm not an empathetic person, a naturally empathetic person. I would be a terrible funeral director or salesperson for that matter, but I get to read all the thank you notes. And for me, the part I didn't anticipate is the impact we're making on people's lives. And my job is, as I've described it, is to get the right person in the arrangement room, get them the resources they need, and get the hell out of their way, because they will work miracles. And I get the positive feedback. Of course, we share all that stuff, but for me, it's having an impact on the community and individual families that I could not do personally. There's no way. So that's the real fulfilling part of being the CEO of Spring Grove right now for me, is just knowing that we're doing a real good job of having families have at least the beginning of the path to closure and a really meaningful goodbye.
Thanks, Gary. That was great. Todd, I have a question for you. I'm rehearsing in case they can. Todd, I'm trying to be a natural host here, facilitator. Todd, a question for you. What is the most funeral director habit that you have that shows up in your personal life?
Oh, my gosh. I really think, you know, that if someone needs something, I'm like, I'll help, you know, even when I probably shouldn't, or I'm over committed. And I think when you I spend enough time as a funeral director to know that when someone asks for help for something in the funeral home, you just do it. Right. And so those habits are so ingrained in me, is when, you know, someone says, hey, I need this or I need that. It's like, I'll volunteer. And even there are days when I don't want to. So that's probably the first one. The other ones, I answer my phone all the time, even when I shouldn't. It's like, I can't let a phone ring without answering it. And it's so hard.
That's the sales training, pal.
That part of it, you know, I always tell the salespeople I work with, you'd be really successful in this business if you do two things. Number one, make phone calls. Number two, return them. You know, it's shockingly simple. But anyways, no, that's a great question. But I would say my number one thing is it's when to stop helping, you know, or when to balance that out. I just learned to say yes. And it served me well, but it's also taken a toll from time to time.
Todd's reply with what's your greatest weakness to interviews is I care too much and work too hard.
The Klepto version.
Exactly.
Jimmy, what is the most unusual or unexpected skill that you've developed in this profession that you never imagined would be part of your job?
Skill in this profession?
Or operating your business, or...
I would say business itself. I'm a social worker, man. So sitting in an arrangement conference room and waiting on families and that face-to-face interaction at a conference table came very natural to me. I really enjoyed it. And then as we've grown our business, I've had to learn to be a business person, a most unlikely business person. And so spreadsheets and finance and can't always be the yes man, because you have to make hard decisions and choices. Mm-hmm. Holding people accountable at times. So learning all of those skills, but balancing it, I think I've found a balance with how to do that with a social worker heart, which has been a surprise for me. So, and I'm still the best vacuum cleaner guy in the whole building.
Absolutely. Perfectly parallel rows. Mm-hmm. I'm impressed.
All right.
Well, those are great answers, guys. Thank you.
No, Matt, thank you. Thank you for the thought that you put into each one of those.
You're welcome. Yeah,
can you teach us how to use GPT to do this next time?
Uh-huh, yeah. You did that really quickly.
Missed my presentation on that in Baltimore.
Well, I got your slides though. Thanks for them.
Yeah, me too.
All right. Well, hey, Gary, your turn. You know, and again, this is the part I feared the most, is turning this over to you. So with that being said, you know,
way too many IQ points that are going behind these questions. Right.
Before we get started,
big words.
That's what our company used to make, those old style tire inflators that you
that's cool.
That was one of our two product lines.
Wow. That is awesome.
Anyway, the others were big industrial steam cleaners, things like, you know, the power washers you roll around on? Ours weighed a ton to a ton and a half. They were for industrial applications.
Zambonis.
Yeah, there you go. A couple of them were that big.
Good money in the Zamboni business.
I've got one question for all three of you because I think this will be enlightening. Is who's had the biggest influence in developing you in this profession and why? Why don't we start with Todd this time since we keep going clockwise?
Yeah, all right. Sounds good. Well, and I'll be happy to. There's probably a two-level question. It's hard for me to always narrow it down to one. So, you know, you're probably figuring that out about me right now. But initially in my career, we had a VP of sales with a previous preenie company I worked with back in the 90s. He was a brilliant man. He was a little challenging personality-wise. His ability to be keep it clean and a-hole was pretty well developed. Okay, so you know, we call that around here. You have your IQ, and then you subtract your a-hole factor to get to your quotient, right? And so his was pretty high. So you know, deductions from IQ. You know, so he can't. You know, but what he was good at was systems and processes. So he taught me, and it served my career very well, how to build a sales organization, how to build sales process. So my role is kind of funny, is it's like I have to develop people so they can develop sales, right? So sales don't grow, sales people grow, that accumulates to sales growth. So he was very, very critical, at a very critical point in my career, good person, the right person at the right time for me. And then later in my career, I mean, our CEO is a wonderful guy. You guys all know Chris, you know, and I'm not sucking up here maybe a little bit, but no, I mean, where I appreciate my current role is having the freedom to, you know, to make, to take care of business and the freedom to, you know, to work the plan, but have a lot of flexibility on how the plan gets worked. So, and just how to run a good business. Very, very fortunate and very blessed to be a part of that. So a little suck up factor there, but Chris will
he doesn't watch the show or listen to the podcast. There's no, yeah, exactly. Don't worry about it. He'll never
heard of him.
Oh, yeah. Good.
Never heard of him. Yeah. So, all right. That's Matt? It. Thank you. Good question.
That's, I agree with Todd. It's hard just to, you know, pinpoint just one individual. I would two that come to mind first, my dad. I mean, I learned from him the power of presence, the impact we have on families that last decades across generations, and the importance and special work of what we do. Working with him and hearing and learning that was what brought me into the profession when I was not planning on doing it. I wasn't, you know, that wasn't my trajectory, but I thought it was really powerful. So that's obviously a huge thing, because I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for that. And the other big one that comes to mind among the many would be the late Doug Manning, and you know, having the chance to meet him and train under him and see his videos and read his books, and his passion for funeral service and his love for funeral directors, even though he wasn't one, and the impact that he had about how we work with families and what people in grief need. And he just, I got a lot of freedom from him when I learned that I didn't have to have the right words, because there are no right words. So it changed everything for me as a funeral director, and learning to just be present for people and just be with them. And that was more liberating than I ever could have imagined. And it's allowed me, I think, to avoid burnout, to, you know, serve people well, and to have those relationships that keep you getting out of bed every day.
Thank you, Matt. Jimmy?
So I'm going to say my grandmother and my father, both starting off as a young funeral director, not knowing that this was, you know, going to be my second and longest forever career. My grandmother was an amazing human being. She herself was not expecting to be in funeral service. She lost the love of her life and one of her sons 12 days apart, and was kind of forced into getting a job and working at the funeral home. And so fast forwarding to when I came along, she was there and helped me navigate those first really uncomfortable sitting in front of a family for the first time, thinking, God, I'm going to screw this up. and just encouraged me, and of course my father with the trust and faith and sometimes patience he had, encouragement. And then there was one other gentleman by the name of Lawrence Hammond, who I give credit for allowing me to give myself permission to have a work-life balance, and have that. He told me that your kids spell love, T-I-M-E, and allowed me to not realize that I had to do it all, but I needed to trust other people, Gary. And so he was on his second career, retired Baptist minister, and I was just starting off. We went to mortuary school together. And so he was at the end of his career. I was at the beginning, and it was just a beautiful. And everything else, like the business side of it, is I am where I am because of failure and getting up and not making that mistake again. And being really vulnerable and calling people in this profession that are held a lot smarter than me and say, will you help me?
Mm. Well, thanks, Jimmy. I'm going to answer my own question because I have a similar path. But I, when I really thought about this, I think I'd have to say Mark Krause. Mark, very early on, befriended me, talked me into going to the university, talked me into, he actually dragged me into the ICCFA leadership. And he's introduced me to all the other people that have had big influences in my life. People like John Horan and Ernie Hefner, Darren Drabing. And I've really
had a good,
well, not you guys. No, I mean, they're satisfied to everything. There has to be an, as Todd said, an AQ, you know, in every group, there's a couple of, but I really do appreciate that because I was very skeptical of how valuable that would be, and I could not have been more wrong. And Mark also served on my board for about 15 years, and really helped me understand how the funeral side of the business worked and what was important. And so I'm forever in his debt just for opening those doors for me. And then everybody else was so accommodating and embracing and open to share. But he's the one that kicked the door open. So that's my answer to the question.
How often is your door kicked open?
By the police, usually once a quarter. I'm trying to get smarter about that.
You have to have a warrant.
Well, and I keep moving. I take the trailer and I go to a different park.
Just drive it somewhere else.
Awesome. I love me some Krause.
A great and thoughtful question, Gary. Appreciate that one. So my turn. All right.
Yes,
so,
fire away.
Hey, I'm going to start off with Jimmy. All right, Jimmy. Bring Why it. The heck did you get thrown out of Ranger Community College?
Good question. All right.
I mean, what do you feel free to share? I don't know if statute of limitations are up. I don't know those things. So.
So I was asked to leave. I had a choice. I never let education get in the way of a good time. You may find that hard to believe. And so in my early college career, that was certainly the case. I was majoring in a good time, and I was very, very, very successful at that. To the point where you're at a small college, and that is noticed, by the way. Not being involved in any of the sports, but we would host certain folks from the college out at the ranch where I was living with a friend. And turns out that time they had at the ranch was getting in the way of what their commitment was on those sports teams.
Ooh.
To the point that I had an excess of absences at the school that was on their policies. However, I wasn't anywhere close to anybody else. Like, it was like no one cared. However, that was the paragraph or the sentence that I had the honor of visiting with the president of Ranger Junior College.
Oh, okay.
And explained to me that that my excessive absences were the reason for me not being able to stay. And I had a choice, is that I could unenroll, or I would be kicked out and not have an opportunity to reapply. So I did what I thought was best, and then I withdrew from school. And I never forget, my dad always used to say, I don't owe you an education, but I can afford one for you as long as you pass. The second that you don't, then you owe me. And I went to work as a roofer during that period in Texas, after leaving the esteemed establishment of Ranger Junior College. And I was the whitest person on that crew, and those guys kicked my ass. They could work circles around me. I was in their way. I was just thankful to have a job, but boy, was I ready to go back to school and change my attitude.
Oh, Mr. Lucas has no great point average.
Fast forward, I ended up graduating college on the dean's list. So, not from Ranger Junior College.
All right. Wow. Valuable life.
There it is. There,
man. Are you still in the CRM where they hit you up for contributions and donations? Or,
you know, I think they just let my name go and didn't bring it back up. I did go back the second semester, though, and did quite well. I think I had a D average when I left there.
Oh, that was the average after two semesters. I'm following. I'm tracking.
If you add them together. Cumulative GPA isn't the total sum.
That's my story. No.
Awesome. Well, thanks for sharing that. I really appreciate that. Oh, man. So, hey, Matt, I'm going to go a little different direction with you. So what's the hardest thing you've ever had to do as a funeral director?
That's bury kids, walk with parents on the day of the unthinkable, and it gets worse when you're a parent yourself. And I've had the burden and honor, depending on how you look at it, of walking with parents through some really challenging times. And we were here in Connecticut, we had the Sandy Hook Elementary School, which will forever be a before and after in my career, in terms of how that happened. And then shortly after that, taking care of two young kids who were murdered by their mother. And, you know, the place they should have been safest turned out to be the place where, because of her mental health and just obvious real problems, the most dangerous place. And to walk with their families and knowing that you can't make it better and you can't do anything really, but those are just really tough days. I would say second to that, maybe even equal in a very different way, was being a funeral director during a global pandemic. As hard as and unthinkable is the taking care of the kids and the things like that is, at least, you know, on Thursday, we have the end of the services and my professional capacity and obligation will be completed. May still be there in a capacity for the parents as a resource, as a guide, but my professional capacity, you know, I just got to hold it together until Thursday. I mean, with the global pandemic, it was people be working 20 hours and Thursday never came. Like, you would go home and the phone would ring again and the nursing home would say, we have four more and we have no room and we don't know what to do. And that was just utter and total exhaustion. I think there was a lot of PTSD that came for a lot of folks working in funeral service. I think it took not weeks or months, maybe for some folks it did, but at least for those of us that are in more densely populated areas where we just had that kind of constant go with it. I think for me, it took a couple of years to really move beyond that experience. And I pray that, you know, hopefully we learned a lot. So if it, God forbid, were to happen again, maybe we'd be in a better shape next time, but I don't think so. I mean, we were hamstrung by a lot of protectionist statutes and laws in our part of this country, and no one has changed them.
Yeah.
You know, we did not allow more crematories to be built. We're not allowing transfers to happen more efficiently. We're not, you know, there's a whole bunch of things that could have changed. They still have not. And it's largely, I think, because of our colleagues mm-hmm. who are short-sighted in how we do some of this stuff. So those are the, those are the dark times in in their own ways. One being, you know, hard as hell, but an honor to be able to help, and the other being something I hope we never see again.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for sharing that. I mean, that's heartfelt. Hey, Gary. All right. So, this I will see how this question goes. I'm kind of excited.
That's so scarce. So,
just the idea of, so Gary, if you were giving career advice to a funeral director apprentice, so you have a unique view kind of coming from outside. Yeah. See, if you were giving career advice to a funeral director apprentice, what would that conversation sound like?
Well, I would probably say the same. I was able to be the commencement speaker for Cincinnati Mortuary College about 2 years ago. And my advice to him was, first to understand what the demands are going to be, you know, go in with your eyes open about what it's like being a hostage to at need. I've always described working at a funeral home as you have a regular pace of business. It's like a restaurant. You know, you have 35 regulars that come in on almost every night. And then every third Saturday, the Shriners are in town and you get four times that many people. So it's chaos. But the primary message I gave him was figure out what kind of life you want to have as a funeral director, because the life of a funeral director at a 200 call firm at one location is very, very different than the life, if you were a funeral director at Spring Grove, where we got 9 locations, 2,200 funerals. The job becomes more bifurcated, in particular between front and back. And if you really want to do everything, we've lost good funeral directors because they really want to do everything, and we make them pick, do you want to be in the care center or do you want to be out front? And I understand there's pride for a funeral director to say, look, I can do it all. I can do anything soup to nuts, prepare for a funeral, and I can handle all the different ethnicities. And I get that, you know, it's a self-confidence and a pride in yourself and your ability to master all that. But believe it or not, the first public speech I gave in this profession was at the ICCFA Fall Management Conference. And it was about how difficult it is to be a funeral director. I think it's the hardest job in the world because at different point, especially in a smaller firm, because the gamut of talent you have to have in the back room, you have to be a scientist. In the arrangement room, you have to be a grief counselor and a therapist and an event planner and a salesperson. Nobody's good at all of that. I thought about other professions. Like if you think about the accounting world, when you start off at the bottom layers, you got to be a really good accountant. But then you get to a certain point and the most important skill you have is sales. And that doesn't normally dovetail with somebody that's wired to be an accountant. So that's why I thought, you know, a single, like a one-person funeral home or a two-person funeral home, the person doing that has to be a chameleon. And that's got to be very tough because one of those aspects of being a funeral director has to be what you're particularly good at or particularly bad at, the weakest at. So the idea would be to try to help the apprentice understand how the profession is migrating and then what it really is on a day-to-day basis, and then let them decide what's the best fit for them. Am I better off back in the back where it's more controlled, but it's more scientific, or am I better? Do I really want what Jimmy was talking about, that one-on-one interaction in the arrangement room, walking somebody through a very difficult time? So that's the perspective I gave in CCMS students.
Awesome. Well, thanks. Hey, all right. So we're going to, I think I covered them all there. We're going to reverse the order, go back through the list, you know, so I'll start and then, kind of scarily Jimmy will finish us off. So let's do this. All right. Hey, so I'm going to start with,
Let's see here. Jimmy. All right.
Bring it.
When you're having one of those lonely and difficult days, what inspires you to keep moving forward?
Oh, man, I have felt that recently. I think knowing that you're just in a moment in time when things are difficult and that this will pass and that you do more good than harm, the services you're providing to people are important, and that not everybody can do what you do. And I it's like a blind faith that you'll get past that moment, and then you come out from on the other side of it. And but it can be pretty lonely actually when you reach that spot, Todd. So you you have a few people maybe you can call and bounce things off of, but sometimes the decisions that you have to make are difficult. And hope I answered your question.
The reason I asked the question was I think a lot of funeral directors, you know, the only one who gets it in their town might be an employee, or it's employee have to go to their boss or the competition, right? They get it and you don't want to share, you know, it's hard. So I think it can be a lonely job. And where you're standing in the prep room on your, you know, second call of the night and it's 3 a.m. and, you know, it's like, you know, those are difficult days. So thank you. All right. Let's see here. I think you guys covered that question for me. So I'm going to go, Matt. I'm reciprocating a little bit about what you asked me, but I did write this one down. So a lot of us are on the same page here, but how has being a funeral director influenced how you live your daily life, Matt?
I had that too. I think, I have that perspective that it goes fast. And, you know, when I started doing this work, I was a young 22 or so, maybe even a little, you know, that was like schooling time. So even a little before that. And I just remember walking folks who are in their 90s out to their car and them telling me, Matt, it goes so fast. You won't believe it. And I've tried to hold on to that and listen to it. And adhere to it. And over the longer you do this work, the more you're serving a clientele of friends, of people that you know and like. I mean, when I started doing it, it was people that knew my dad. It was, you know, folks in the community who've used this before, but, you know, I didn't necessarily know personally. As the years go on and you're involved in your community and you meet people in different ways, in different capacities, you start walking into see hospice beds with your friend in them, and that it gets jarring in certain ways too, where, you know, we had a couple of years ago, it was, do we take this trip that we've taken in the past? Because the way things are right now, it's gotten a lot more expensive than it used to be. And is it, could we really, you know, justify it? And then we would look around and say, these two people aren't here anymore, and these other three are fighting and may not be here soon. So I think for me, it's, you know, take advantage of the opportunity when it comes your way. Don't put off until tomorrow, because it's not promised to any of us. And as my dad always likes to say, if you only get one life, but you live it right, once is enough. So, you know, I think that's how I try to do it.
Awesome. Well, thank you. All right, Gary. Yeah. Hey, Gary, with you, when it comes to leadership, because I know you enjoy, you're a very solid leader. That's important to you. So what's the most valuable lesson you've learned when it comes to leadership?
Well, it's the downside of delegation. And that is you have to let people beneath you make mistakes. Because otherwise they're not going to grow. And I've talked about this. I talk about this at the ICCFA University, is that as a leader, if your employees aren't making mistakes, they're not growing. And I tell anybody that works with me, I expect you to make mistakes. You got to own them when you make them, but I expect you to make mistakes, because if you aren't, you're not working fast enough. The other side of that is there have been points in time where somebody's come to me with an idea. hey, I want to go do this. And I'm thinking, that is never going to work. So my reaction as a leader is to say, okay, if you want to try that, here's what would concern me. I don't tell them no. I don't say, hey, that's not going to work, and here's why. I say, you can go down that path if you want, but here's my concerns. And one of two things happens. I was right, and it didn't work. It helps that person identify the weaknesses in that idea, and therefore they're more attuned to it, and they're more likely to pull up before it becomes really bad. And the other part of it is about 15-20% of the time, I'm wrong. And you know what? It worked. I never thought it would. But it does bring a diversity of thought in a real way into an organization. I tell people, I try really hard not to give edicts and not to tell people how to run their portion of the business. I've probably in 23 years given three things where I said, guys, normally we'll discuss this and decide what the best path is. We're not going to do that this time. I'm pulling the CEO card. This is what we're going to go do. Your job is to keep it from going off the rails. But I try really hard not to do that unless it's something I believe we need to try as an organization, even though everybody in the leadership team thinks that is the dumbest thing I've ever heard. And right. It turns out the three times I gave an A, it really was the right answer. But that's the part I tell, I think I've said this on the podcast once before. If you own a funeral home and you have a funeral director that tries to innovate and it blows up in their face, the last thing you want to do is go criticize them, especially publicly, because it's the last time that person will ever innovate and probably the last time your company will ever innovate. If as long as they were trying to do something for the benefit of the family and it just didn't work, you got to say, hey, we gave it a shot. It didn't work. You know, I tell owners, expect to pay for a couple of funerals every year because it's the nature of the business. Otherwise, you're not innovating. So
yeah,
it's just a different perspective.
Awesome. Well, thank you. Mm-hmm. All right, Gary, you got the hot hand. So why don't you go ask your next question?
Well, Matt kind of asked me the second question I was going to ask, but I wanted to know, starting with Jimmy, what made you decide to stop your career path and go into something else or go into funeral service with your father? Was there some event or just a perspective?
So I grew up in the funeral home, right? So what I knew was that the last thing I wanted to do as a kid is to spend the rest of my life at a funeral home. I mean, no cell phone, no Wi-Fi. You showed up, you worked, you swept, you moved flowers. And then as I grew away from that, Dad sold our family business in the mid-80s. He moved to Houston to work for Mr. Waltrip. And we all grew up, did our deal. I always knew that I wanted to do something to help people. That was never a question for me. My mom was a social worker, so being a social worker just seemed right. I got into, and I was an investigator with Child Protective Services. So I would knock on people's door and try to help kids. And doing that for 3 years, it just, I was ready for a change. Talk about a tough job, you know? Yeah. So my father was still in the profession, but on the pre-need side of things. And he had an opening. I was ready for a change. And so I went to work with him, going to every convention there was, the small little state conventions, peddling pre-need. And that's when I, as an adult, fell in love with funeral service again, as an adult, and meeting these funeral directors, realizing, like, I remember these are the folks that helped me with my homework, that were sweet and kind to me. And I remember walking into my dad's office one day and said, have you ever thought about maybe us getting back into funeral service, where we had a funeral home and we could help families in that way? And I think my father had some guilt for selling our family business, and he didn't hesitate. And it was from that point on, we started with one and, you know, morphed since 2000, 2001. But it was a strange transition. So it was back in professionally, but on the pre-need side, that led to us getting our old, one of our old funeral homes back where my grandmother still worked. So I got to go and work with my grandmother at that first level. And, yeah, it was not in my cards. As my wife says, I did not marry a funeral director. I married a social worker and and all the things that she had no idea came with being a funeral director and an owner of a funeral home. At the time, a small funeral home.
Yeah. Thank you, Jimmy. And Matt, you mentioned earlier in this podcast that you were on a totally different track. What were you headed before you went back into the funeral business like Jimmy did?
To be determined, really. I mean, I was doing my undergraduate studies at the Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C., and I was studying politics there. I always had an interest in that area, but as time went on, seeing people who lived and worked in D.C. and how miserable they seemed to be, it lost a lot of its appeal. The Thursday night pitcher of margarita night at Red River Grill, where all the Capitol Hill staffers went to hang out, they just seemed terrible. So I was like, I wasn't sure about that. I was deserting a vocation with the priesthood in the Roman Catholic Church, and had a lot of those conversations with folks as well. Marketing was always something I was interested in communications. I actually had a friend who was a couple of years ahead of me in college, and she was a producer for one of the NBC affiliates in the DC metro area, or Baltimore, I believe. And she was talking about helping me get a gig as a weatherman. So, you know, it was kind of a meteorologist.
That's a shotgun blast.
50% chance.
Which I always thought would be like, the greatest, like those are the ones they send out to like the pizza festival, the strawberry shortcake festival, and you get stuff. And like people, you know, make fun of them because they're wrong so often, but they all seem to like the people still. So it's like, they're always wrong, but oh, it's so-and-so. So it's like, that could be a worse way to make a living. But I'm not a super morning person, so that could be a couple different directions. But yeah, it was to be determined, really. I mean, I was kind of all over the place, I guess, before I harnessed all those skills together and brought them to the death care space. So.
That's great. And Todd, what, I think you talked a little bit about it, but what was the shift between being a funeral director and then going into sales? Was it just the lifestyle commitment that you were looking for, the lifestyle control of your own time more than anything else?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it's kind of, I'm going to back it up a little bit, Gary, but I went to college to be an engineer.
Wow.
And yeah, that's where I started. And in the Institute of Technology program at the University of Minnesota. And fortunately, they had a mortuary science program too. So, but as I started to see that I didn't think my personality style would align with engineering. I was always a math and science guy growing up. I actually like spreadsheets, Jimmy. So, I enjoy that stuff.
A warm blanket.
exactly. Yeah, I just finished one yesterday. It's like, oh, that was a complicated, but I enjoy that, and I enjoy that. I always had an interest in computers and technology and. But when I got to the University of Minnesota, then I got into funeral service. And if part of the trigger is knowing that it was an available option because my friend Mike. But the other one was combining this idea of, I think we talked about it, Gary, you mentioned, is science in the back room and the anatomy and all that and the pathology. And then you got the front side of the house, which is the social working, the psychology, the caring for people. And then the business side, the accounting and, you know, marketing and business. So I thought it was a really an interesting combination. But when I got into funeral service, I'm just, you know, kind of, I've shared the story a lot with a lot of people on a one-on-one level. It's never put this in a public forum like this before. But my older brother and I graduated college the same year. Within a couple of weeks apart. And so, you know, we were always close growing up. And so about the 5-year mark, you know, it's like, I'm just looking around, you know, going, you know, what do I want to do for the rest of my life? You know, I enjoyed being a funeral director, love the profession. And, but my brother and I were kind of trading notes, and is like, well, he's a school teacher. It's teaching fifth grade, loves his life. And, you know, it's his summer's off and he's working like 185 days a year. Right. And I'm working as a funeral director and loving my life and all that. But it was like, I'm working maybe 300 days a year. And guess what, Gary? Our pay was within about $1,000 a year of each other.
What's wrong with this picture?
Yeah.
Sounds like you were overpaid.
So my thought was, I'm going to go back to mortuary school, or I'm going to, I could go back to school and become a teacher and love that lifestyle. Or I could go do something else. And about that time, I got a call from a friend of mine who's he was my pre-need guy back in Minnesota. Back then, it was illegal for a licensed funeral director to receive a commission on a pre-need insurance policy sale.
Wow.
So we had a guy that we called, and he's been a great friend since like 1989, 1990. And he said, "Hey, I just referred you to someone because I know you love pre-need and I know you love funeral service. Just hear this guy out on a pre-need management position, and I think you'd be good at it." So I just took the call, and then one thing led to another, and it's like, well, and I dreamed of owning my own funeral home, but in the mid '90s, Loan and SCI were buying everything, and it was like, I don't know if that's going to pan out, but if I go this way, at least I can be in charge of my schedule. So it was really largely schedule driven. I need to be on the road, but at least I can pick the days I'm on the road to an extent. I got to stay in funeral service. I loved the fact that I got to stay in funeral service, but in a different role.
Yeah. Makes sense. All right. I guess we're turning the ball back over to Matt.
I have a question real quick.
Sure. It's not your turn.
I know. That's why I'm taking over. Go ahead, Matt.
No, you have it. Why not?
My question was, in a fantasy world that none of us are in funeral service, you were not doing engineering stuff or whatever you guys were doing, what would your vocation or job be? Like, if you could do anything you wanted to do, but outside of what you've done or what you're doing, mm-hmm. what would you do?
I think travel or food reporter.
I could see that one. I would have a wood shop. And I'd be making stuff day in and day out. Like, it's like, what are you doom scrolling on Facebook? I was like, I'm watching how they make epoxy poured tables right now. It's like, I love that. I just love building stuff and, working with my hands. That's what I do.
I probably honestly would be hopefully running a company about Spring Grove scale, but owning it. So I wouldn't have to, the downside for me is, I've got three boards of directors, and it gets complicated because of the legal structure in the state of Ohio. I always wanted to be an entrepreneur. I always wanted to be in the small company world. And I really like the size Spring Grove is. We're, depending upon what time of the year it is, we're between 220 and 270 employees. So you get to know most of them. And it's fun growing and building a business and growing and building the people in it, that's been very rewarding for me. And it may be the favorite thing I have about Spring Grove. We've roughly tripled the size of the business since I got here. And, it's that in and of itself, who cares, but it's the opportunities and the growth of the people, because if you're growing there's more things that they can take on, learn, grow. And it's that part of it's been very, very rewarding. So I think I would be in the same role. I'd be an owner instead of an operator.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting. Excellent. Well, I'm glad Jimmy went first. So now we can save the best for last, Matt. So
I'll do real quick answers, probably lightning rounds. Todd, you might've just touched on it, I don't know, but I was wondering outside of the funeral service space, what like hobbies or interests that you have that people who don't know you might be surprised to hear about.
Yeah, good question. I kind of did tip my hand. If you see my stuff on Facebook, I'm usually, when I build something, I post. Like right now, I'm rebuilding my fence, and there are people in my life, are like, you can hire people to do that. It's like, I know I can, but I really like doing that. My dad was a blue collar guy, and proudly so. He worked with his hands, he did his own things, and that was a big influence on me, is watching him do those things. And so I kind of feel like I'm working next to my dad at those moments, when I'm doing manual labor, but also it just clears my mind, mm-hmm. And you have to reason through and think through a project, and I can get away from, all the people stuff that I'm involved with on a day to day. People think I'm fairly outgoing, but I'm actually kind of not as much as people think I am. But so I like that alone time or just having time with one of my sons or my wife, and we're just working on the yard or building something.
cool. I was going to ask Gary if it's him that has alerts going off on his computer or not, but I won't do that.
Instead, I'll ask.
I'm trying to turn one thing off and not turn off the podcast. It's my fault.
Gary, I just wonder if was there any piece of advice you received early on in your space and deaf care that you at first ignored but later came to realize was probably worth listening to?
Wow. Gosh, I hope not. I would say probably assessments of people, because I'm not a very good reader of people and first impressions kind of person. I don't have that perception. But when I came into the profession, I didn't know anything from anything. And I was surrounded by a bunch of people that had been in the profession a long time, both in Spring Grove and then later outside Spring Grove. So I tried to stay very, very open to where the profession was going and figuring out who was the smartest person in the room and just listening to them and then try to bring whatever was applicable back. But yeah, we hit on interview questions, and I got the question, you know, what's your biggest weakness? And mine is easy. I've never fired anybody fast enough. Never. Mm-hmm. Not once. I always have an optimistic view, give them another chance. Hey, they can learn that skill. And about 15% of the time I've been right.
Yeah. I think that probably tracks with a lot of us. And Jimmy, yeah, I just wonder, you know, switching from, you know, social work, child protective services, all that stuff into funeral services, has there been a moment in your career where you said to yourself, I chose this. This was the right calling. Something that you encountered or struck where you said, "I'm where I'm supposed to be."
Every day, actually, I love what I do, and I get up and feel like I never go to work, which I don't think most people can have that feeling. It's tough, and there's moments you're just like, "Yeah, I know why my friend sold their funeral home a day like today." But I love not just the families that provide us a sacred trust to serve them, but I feel the same about my coworkers who we partner with to deliver that sacred promise.
Great.
Man, I think with that, we need to end. That was a great comment there, Jimmy. Thank you.
Thanks,
Jimmy. Hey, we are at the end of our time, and I just want to thank our listeners of the Graveyard Shift for tuning in on this episode. I hope there's some way, form or fashion, you connect in your own way to some of the words that were shared today, and that will keep you plugged in and engaged and excited to serve families. That's what it's all about. So I just want to thank our panel today, man. Great work. Very thoughtful. And you can tell you guys, to call Gary a heartfelt leader might be a stretch, but you know, Gary, thank you.
No, heartless. No, that's the word you're looking for.
He is a teddy bear. Don't let anybody tell you any different.
But I just want to say really, really, man, I thank you for bearing your soul a little bit here in this forum. And because I do think it's on all of us to support each other and to make sure this profession continues to be what it is and continues to grow and attract great people. So thank you for that. Thank you for listening to The Graveyard Shift. If you have some comments or feedback or words of encouragement, send them over to thegraveyardshift@passari.com. As always, put something you learned in use today and don't keep us a secret. Take care.